TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Mary Oliver. When the poet Mary Oliver passed in her 83rd year on January 17, 2019, the huge response revealed her as one of the most popular writers of our time. That despite of her refusal to be famous or rich and the few interviews she gave, she wanted her poems to speak for themselves and came up with titles such as Owls and Other Fantasies, The Leaf and the Cloud, Wild Geese and the Truro Bear. A dear friend wrote to me, "I can't think of a contemporary poet who better than Oliver expresses such depth of feeling and thought about the natural world and what it is to experience Earth as an animal in the web of life." And I like the fact that her work is accessible and has reached a large audience. End quote. Mary Oliver's poems arrived where I now live, on the edge of a meadow in oak and madrone woodlands in Northern California, as I'm trying to read and understand the unprecedented changes of the last 20 years in the ecology around me. Mary Oliver gave two of her rare readings at the Lannan Foundation in Santa Fe, New Mexico. They are a family foundation dedicated to cultural freedom, diversity, and creativity. They support contemporary artists and writers and rural indigenous communities. Their speaker series is carefully produced and posted on their website as audio or video podcasts. I'm acknowledging the Lannan Foundation for excerpts from the August 2001 reading by Mary Oliver and for a short quote from an interview by Joseph Parisi with her from October 2006. Here's Joe Parisi, former editor-in-chief of Poetry Magazine.
Years ago, I had a conversation with James Merrill. Among other things, he's talking about the destruction not only of this world, but of the soul afterlife because of our tampering with and misuse of technology and so forth. And Jimmy, in his usual way, he said, well, you know, we think about the so-called barbarians and the ancients, the pagans, and they did horrible things and brutal things sometimes, but they never really disrespected nature. In fact, they were in awe of it. We're the first who really got so smart that we have outsmarted ourselves and broken this bond, nature. Most poets probably feel the same way, that an almost desperate need to talk about the earth and what we've done to it and the ecology. William said, yeah, we have to talk about it before it's too late. And do you sometimes get this feeling maybe that we're really in the desperate hours now?
Oh, I totally believe we're in desperate hours, desperate straits. And I think we're plunging toward doom if we don't do something about it. But I'm not an environmentalist. Somebody said I was. I said, no, I'm not, because my first reason for feeling we should must save the earth. We know we must, but there's a deeper reason, which is we should, because the earth is sacred, and we are savaging it.
That was Mary Oliver in October 2006. Now you will hear her selection from her 2001 reading at the Lannan Foundation. She came to the podium with a pile of books and a reading list. She went at her own pace, and I decided not to shorten the pauses between poems when she opens the pages in another book. I also left the sequence that she had carefully designed and only removed six to bring the reading into the TUC Radio time slot. I also left in place the poem she opens with, even though it jolted some in the audience. They had placed her work mainly among roses and other flowers. And I almost believe she intended the gentle shock. Mary Oliver.
This is a poem called The Fish. The first fish I ever caught would not lie down quiet in the pail, but flailed and sucked at the burning amazement of the air and died in the slow pouring off of rainbows. Later, I opened his body and separated the flesh from the bones and ate him. Now the sea is in me. I am the fish. The fish glitters in me. We are risen, tangled together, certain to fall back to the sea. Out of pain and pain and more pain, we feed this feverish plot. We are nourished by the mystery. I'm tied. George Eliot and her husband, really, George Lewis, used to refer to some of the material goods that they have by the names of books. They would take out their new set of dishes and say, these are the Silas Marner dishes. Or the Mill on the Floss curtains. And we have at least a few cups and saucers that are the wild geese cups and saucers in our household. So this is wild geese. You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese high in the clean blue air are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over, announcing your place in the family of things. Of course, these are the geese of Beech Forest. Well, I was watching one of them, lovely creatures, and wanted to write another poem, but having just written Wild Geese, I thought I would fancy it up. This is the poem called The Swan. Doesn't matter. There's a reference in this poem to Mrs. Blake. This is, of course, the wife of the poet William Blake. I think that's all you need. The Swan. Across the wide waters, something comes floating, a slim and delicate ship filled with white flowers. And it moves on its miraculous muscles as though time didn't exist, as though bringing such gifts to the dry shore was a happiness almost beyond bearing. And now it turns its dark eyes. It rearranges the clouds of its wings. It trails an elaborate webbed foot, the color of charcoal. Soon it will be here. Oh, what shall I do when that poppy-colored beak rests in my hand? Said Mrs. Blake of the poet, I miss my husband's company. He is so often in paradise. Of course, the path to heaven doesn't lie down in flat miles. It's in the imagination with which you perceive this world and the gestures with which you honor it. Oh, what will I do? What will I say when those white wings touch the shore? When I was very young, I had a wonderful little picture of William Blake, and I cut it out, and I wrote on the back of it, Uncle William. And I carried it in my wallet. I'll be reading, two or three prose poems. And this is one, and it is one of the newer poems for tonight. It's called The Word. How wonderful. I speak of the soul, and seven people rise from their chairs and leave the room. Seven others lean forward to listen. I speak of the body, the spirit, the mockingbird, the hollyhock, leaves opening in the rain, music, faith, angels seen at dusk. And seven more people leave the room and are seen running down the road. Seven more stay where they are but make murmurous, disruptive sounds. Another seven hang their heads, feigning disinterest, though their hearts are open. Their hope is high that they will hear the word even again. They know already how everything is better, the dark trees less terrible, the ocean less hungry, when it comes forth and looks around with its crisp and lovely eye and begins to sing. One of our great assistances is, of course, punctuation. But it occurred to me that perhaps each of us writers has only perhaps a finite amount of it for our use. And we should use it judiciously, lest we hear a voice suddenly when we need it saying, "No more semicolons." You're finished with your dashes. And also that passive-aggressive comma with which we so carefully set off what is nice so it won't be missed. Don't we? So I thought of, for fun, and I've done this a few times, I would write a poem that uses no punctuation. And this particular one has a question mark, which is quite apparent at the end, and see what I could do simply with the line break and the cadence of the line and so forth. And it is a little, leaves you a little breathless to read and perhaps to listen to also, but here goes. It's called Seven White Butterflies. Seven white butterflies, delicate in a hurry, look how they bang the pages of their wings as they fly to the fields of mustard, yellow and orange and plain gold. All eternity is in the moment. This is what Blake said, Whitman said, such wisdom in the agitated motions of the mind. Seven dancers floating, even as worms toward paradise. See how they banter and riot and rise to the trees, flutter, lob their white bodies into the invisible wind, weightless, lacy, willing to deliver themselves unto the universe now. Each settles down on a yellow thumb, on a brassy stem now. All seven are rapidly sipping from the golden towers. Who would have thought it could be so easy? That cost me one question mark. A poem that's a little longer, and again a new one. I'm going to snap this shut. And it's in four parts, and again has a horrendously long first sentence, so you have to help me hang on to the syntax. It's called 100 White-Sided Dolphins on a Summer Day, and I hope it's the experience of many, many people here. It's in four parts, but that's really organizational. I won't say the numbers. Fat, black, slick, galloping in the pitch of the waves, in the pearly fields of the sea, they leap toward us. They rise sparkling and vanish and rise sparkling. They breathe little clouds of mist. They lift perpetual smiles. They slap their tails on the waves, grandmothers and grandfathers enjoying the old jokes. They circle around us. They swim with us. 100 white-sided dolphins on a summer day, each one, as God himself could not appear more acceptable 100 times, in a body blue and black, threading through the sea foam and lifting himself up from the opened tents of the waves on his fish tail to look with the moon of his eye into my heart and find there pure, sudden, steep, sharp, painful gratitude that falls, I don't know, either unbearable tons or the pale, bearable hand of salvation on my neck, lifting me from the boat's plain plank seat into the world's unspeakable kindness. It is my 63rd summer on earth, and for a moment, I have almost vanished into the body of the dolphin, into the moon eye of God, into the white fan that lies at the bottom of the sea with everything that ever was or ever will be, supple, wild, rising on flank or fishtail, singing or whistling or breathing damply through blowhole at top of head. Then, in our little boat, the dolphins suddenly gone, we sailed on through the brisk, cheerful day. Sometimes people say, what's your favorite poem? You want to say macaroni or something. But I often say this poem. I think because I got something that was very close for me to the experience. It's called I Found a Dead Fox, which is the first line of it. I found a dead fox beside the gravel road, curled inside the big iron wheel of an old tractor that had been standing for years in the vines at the edge of the road. I don't know what happened to it, when it came there, or why it lay down for good, settling its narrow chin on the rusted rim of the iron wheel to look out over the fields and that way died. But I know this, its posture of looking to the last possible moment back into the world made me want to sing something joyous and tender about foxes. But what happened is this. When I began, when I crawled in through the honeysuckle and lay down, curling my long spine inside that cold wheel, and touched the dead fox and looked out into the wide fields, the fox vanished. There was only myself and the world, and it was I who was leaving. And what could I sing then? Oh, beautiful world, I just lay there and looked at it. And then it grew dark. That day was done with. And then the stars stepped forth and held up their appointed fires, those hot, hard watchmen of the night. really like these grim subjects. I seem to have thrown in a very recent poem. I guess this is a prose poem, too. We're coming along here to the end, but this is called Blue Iris, and this is really recent. Dangerous to read that, but I'm going to. Prose poem. Two voices kind of speaking, I think. Now that I'm free to be myself, who am I? Can't fly, can't run, and see how slowly I walk. Well, I think I can read books. What's that you're doing? The green-headed fly shouts as it buzzes past. I close the book. Well, I can write down words like these softly. What's that you're doing? Whispers the wind, pausing in a heap just outside the window. Give me a little time, I say back to its staring silver face. It doesn't happen all of a sudden, you know. Doesn't it, says the wind, and breaks open, releasing distillation of blue iris. And my heart panics not to be, as I long to be, the empty, waiting, pure, speechless receptacle. My ambition hath ceased. Roses late summer. What happens to the leaves after they turn red and golden and fall away? What happens to the singing birds when they can't sing any longer? What happens to their quick wings? Do you think there is any personal heaven for any of us? Do you think anyone, the other side of that darkness, will call to us, meaning us? Beyond the trees, the foxes keep teaching their children to live in the valley. So they never seem to vanish. They are always there in the blossom of light that stands up every morning in the dark sky. And over one more set of hills along the sea, the last roses have opened their factories of sweetness and are giving it back to the world. If I had another life, I would want to spend it all on some unstinting happiness. I would be a fox or a tree full of waving branches. I wouldn't mind being a rose in a field full of roses. Fear has not yet occurred to them, nor ambition. Reason they have not yet thought of. Neither do they ask how long they must be roses and then what. Or any other foolish question. This is a poem about the old burn dump that we hear so much about, where I used to go and gather blackberries and red raspberries and Lord knows what toxins on their lovely stems. This is called Wrens. Here I go into the wide gardens of waste fields, blue glass, clear glass, and other rubbishes blinking from the dust, from the fox tracks, among the roots and risings of buttercups, Joe Pye, honeysuckle, the queen's lace, and her blue sailors. The little wrens have carried 100 sticks into an old rusted pail, and now they are singing in the curtains of leaves. They are fluttering down to the bog. They are dipping their darling heads down to wet their whistles. How happy they are to be diligent at last, foolish birds. And this is called The Summer Day. More questions. Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? This grasshopper, I mean. The one who has flung herself out of the grass. The one who is eating sugar out of my hand. Who is moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down. Who is gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I have been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? Thank you.
That was Mary Oliver in a reading at the Lannan Foundation in August 2001. She was mourned by friends of her writing across the world when she passed in her 83rd year on January 17, 2019. Her many immensely popular books include Red Bird, A Thousand Mornings, Dog Songs, and Blue Horses. The Lannan Foundation in Santa Fe, New Mexico, supports contemporary artists and writers and rural indigenous communities. Their speaker series is posted on their website as audio or video podcast. That's lannan.org, LANNAN.org. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.